So tonight we're continuing with the exploration of my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness, How Embodying the Cosmic Perspective Can Liberate Your Life. Our next chapter, chapter 9, is entitled The Three Poisons and the Three Practices. Our first quote is by the bard Shakespeare from the play Hamlet. Though this be madness, yet there is method in it. Our second quote is from the Culture Club. Love is hard to find in the church of the poisoned mind. So I always try to find some sayings, both ancient and contemporary, that provide a sort of platform from which to do the Dharma talk. And I have to confess, there's a show that I've been watching. They're little small interviews that Larry King does with different, you know, celebrities. And he'll ask them questions, you know, things that nobody might know about them. And one of them is, what is your secret or guilty pleasure? And my wife and I were out to dinner one night. We played that game together, which was fun. And I love all kinds of music. I mean, I really do. I mean, my home ground is what they now call classic rock. Led Zeppelin, The Who, yes. But I've also been a big fan of some forms of country music, classical music, I mean, international music. I love it all. But my guilty pleasure that a lot of people don't know about me is I have a great affection for pop music from the early 80s. So those who know me well would not find it strange that I would quote Boy George along with Hamlet. And I love that line from the song, love is hard to find in the church of the poisoned mind. So in the Buddhist tradition, there has always been an understanding that there are three primary poisons that can affect the mind. And these poisons can kill the spirit. And you might say that the reason for being of the Buddhist faith is to provide an antidote to these poisons. And so what I'm going to do tonight is describe them within the reference point of the three principles of oneness, and then talk about the three practices. And if you haven't caught on yet, Buddhists are fond of systematizing things, giving them numbers. So the first poison, and I should mention too that in our liturgy, when we do the accord, we talk about these three poisons and making an accord with them. So the first poison is known as delusion. And this is an important subject because of several things. One is there are some spiritual traditions that teach that the world is an illusion. In other words, the world outside of my mind is an illusion. And in fact, in ancient India, the term for that was Maya. And it's not a coincidence that that was the name of Buddha's mother, who died giving birth to him. But Buddhists do not believe that the world is an illusion. Rather, what we believe is that the way within which we see the world is delusional. That's an important point because when you talk about the world as illusory, and there are intelligent ways that one can do that, of course, and poetic ways. But in some way, I've found that it can often deny the reality of this world. I remember one time at an interfaith conference, I was on a panel, and the person who was moderating the panel asked me, you know, what's the difference between the Indian Hindu view of Maya or illusion, and what's the Buddhist difference? And, you know, as a raconteur, I enjoy speaking and using words, hopefully effectively and humorously. But I really felt that the best way to demonstrate that was not through words, but through actions. And so when the moderator, the very nice fellow beside me who was the Hindu priest, said that, you know, all of this world is an illusion. It's not real. On the moment, spontaneously dipped my hand in the cup of water that I had in front of me. And I took the cup of water and I sprinkled it in the face of the moderator. And to his credit, he laughed heartily and he got the point that, you know, we can say whatever we want. That doesn't make it so. And even if on some subatomic level, all things are nothing but photons and in space, creating time. When I stub my toe getting up in the morning, I'm very aware that there's still a reality there. So for the Buddhists, we don't want to deny the world, but we want to see it clearly. And the Buddhist conviction is that our biggest problem is that we don't see the world clearly, and that our perceptions are veiled as through a glass darkly, and that our practices can lead us into a more enlightened perspective where we really do see things as they actually are, as much as that is possible for any human being. So what is the main delusion, this poison of the mind? That delusion is to see everything and everyone as separate, existing all on their own with no help from anyone else. So that is the first teaching that we sit with. Is this so? Now, as I said earlier, talking in the last chapter about the three principles, you know, there's a sort of two-pronged process that we go through before we move out of delusion. The first is when the hardships of life make it very clear to us that any Pollyannish view will quickly be decimated by whatever deal we're currently getting in life, if it's an unfortunate one. And whenever we're dealt that card, the first phase is to realize we've been a bit delusional. We haven't really been seeing things as they are. And that first phase is kind of hard. And it is the traditional way that Buddhist teachings have started. So, for example, to say that all life is filled with suffering. Now, that sounds a bit pessimistic, right? But I don't see it that way. And in fact, I would argue that if it was pessimistic, then billions of Buddhists would not have been pursuing this over the last 3,000 years as a form of liberation. Rather, I see it sort of like the blues. You know, and in our modern American music movement, we have different forms of the blues. The original blues came out of the black community, and I have a great love for that style. And then there were what they might call white man's blues, and that was country music. And if you've ever listened to country music for 20 minutes, you're going to get a pretty good idea that it's a white man's blues. And then I love the description as of metal, the metal, as modern blues. So the blues, what are they? Well, if you listen to the lines or songs of a blues song, and you could even say that that's true in pop music, as our line from the Church of the Poison Mind Culture Club displays. But the fact of the matter is that the blues are there not to make us feel worse. The blues are there to help make us feel one with everyone else who has ever paid their dues and sung the blues. And by doing that, it somehow lifts our spirit. Because I believe in a way it connects us and makes us feel one. So when I hear the first so-called noble truth, as it's sometimes presented, that all life is filled with suffering, or all life in one way or another is unsettling or out of harmony, I don't hear that as a negative. I hear that as something akin to the blues. It's saying something honest about life, right? That it's expressing an honest emotion, that that's how we feel when we're not awake. When we're not awake and we're being honest, the world is rough, man. It's hard. And that teaching alone existentially can help us, just like the blues. But it's not all of the teaching. This is the first phase. The second phase of the teaching, which I have tried very hard to illuminate through the three principles, is to understand that this idea of seeing everything and everyone as separate is a delusion. And that when we bear witness to what we can know about this world, this universe, everything is actually intimately related. And the idea of me being separate is just false. That's something created by my mind. It's not something that's real. It's something that I bring to cause in my reaction to the toughness of life. And that's how we as Buddhists distinguish between pain and suffering. For us, pain is not something that we ever can escape. We can try to dull the pain. We can try to keep ourselves out of painful situations, but even that can be painful. For us, suffering is the story or the narrative that we put around the pain. And while pain is a part of life, suffering is optional. And I know that sounds hard for people, but that's what the Buddha lays out for us. And any of us that even in a little way bring that practice into being in our own lives, we know it's true. We know that suffering is a choice that And in some ways, it's what separates us from the rest of creation. I take delight in that my beloved cat, Sir Basil, will never know suffering the way I know. So what's the antidote? Well, let me describe the poisons first, and then I'll talk about the antidotes. But that's delusion, to see everything and everyone as separate. And when we see everything as separate, we get lonely, and we feel like we're alone and isolated. And that's what makes humans do weird stuff. That's what Western psychology calls neurosis. That's when we get neurotic. So what happens when we see everything as separate and we kind of have this reality check and we like, oh yeah, man. Well, the next poison is caused, and that poison is greed. Greed. And what happens when this sense of separation becomes very strong in us, and maybe sometimes not that strong, it leads to possessiveness. It leads to exaggerating what the object of our desire can bring. And this possessiveness on this projected object, whether it be a person, place, or thing, we want to possess it as an unconscious way to overcome the sense of separation. Because we believe that if, in our deluded mind, that somehow if I possess this thing, that that's how I'll be happy. That's why I won't be alone anymore. I won't be separate anymore if I possess this thing, this person, place, or thing. If I'm there in this place, or I have this person, or I have this thing, then I won't be unhappy anymore. I won't feel separate anymore. And that's what drives greed. And guess what happens? One of the things that we teach in the four direction system of mindfulness are various models of what the world is like. And what happens is that whatever it is we're trying to possess, it's going to change. And that changing could happen in a way that would reaffirm the sense of separation again. You know? So greed is very subtle, but it's driven by that sense of separation and wanting to overcome. You know? And one of the ways we try to overcome things is status. And that's not something unique to humans. If you study primates, you'll find they do the same thing. Status was a way for us to feel like we belonged. And not only did we belong, but man, we were kind of in control of the separation. And so we get greedy because we think somehow that will overcome that separation we believe is real. And what happens whenever something we wish to possess changes in a way that we no longer believe we will possess it, and thus we will be separate and alone once again? Hatred. Hatred is the effect. When the object cannot be possessed, it must be destroyed so no one else can have it. When the object can no longer be possessed, then it must be destroyed so no one else can have it. And we see that sort of thing played out all too well. And the other form of hatred occurs when the projection wanes. Because one of the things we understand in our teachings is that projection, albeit a natural process of perception, goes through cycles like the cycle of the moon. You know, it waxes and wanes. The moon's still there. It's just that our projection, the light that we've projected on it from our own psyche, goes through that process. And what happens when it wanes? What happens when it starts to go dark? We don't want it anymore. The thing that we wanted to possess so much no longer does it for us. We don't want it. And so we begin to hate it, particularly if it's persistent. Its presence is persistent and the projection is waning. We hate it. And so this is the way within which these three poisons work together. They start from the delusion of separation, and then to overcome that separation, we scramble through greed. And then whenever that wears out, for whatever reason, then we begin to hate. And we also hate those who we think possess things that we don't have. That's another causal effect relationship between greed and hatred. You have what I don't have. At least I perceive I don't have. In some cases, you do have what I don't have. Maybe you're smarter than me. Maybe you were born into a circumstance that was a silver spoon, and I was born with a plastic spoon in my mouth. Maybe you're better looking than I. There's so many ways. And we feel that we don't have that, and others do, and we'll never have it, so we hate them. And you know, there's little side poisons. They're not quite as strong, like envy. And a reaction to thinking that what we desire, we can't have. Sloth. You know, so human wisdom traditions know this stuff well. So this prescription, this description, this diagnosis is not hard for us to understand. But what do we do about it? Well, the Buddha discovered a way that he was very clear was not something that it was original to him, but that it was universal wisdom. And that his enlightenment, his illumination was to share that for the human race, to share that with all human beings. And in the next chapter, I talk about the metaphors of that as the discoveries of fire. How they change things. But tonight, just let me talk about the antidotes. So what are the antidotes? Well, they're usually known as three. And we also talk about these as the three foundations of practice. So the antidotes are, and you might say the antidote is. If you say the antidote is, what is the antidote? Mindfulness. In a word, sati. Mindfulness. However, it's usually understood that mindfulness is a part of a three-legged stool, and that seat of wisdom is made up of mindfulness, meditation and precepts. So the way within which we overcome these poisons even transmute them is through the antidotes of mindfulness, meditation, and precepts. So how does that work? Well, first of all, there's the antidote of what I call calming clarity, or clarity and calm. And that is the practice of mindfulness and meditation. So what is mindfulness? Very simply, mindfulness is understanding the process by which our thoughts create our perceptions. And that these thoughts or perceptions in turn have been created by beliefs that we've developed as we've grown. And most of these beliefs were not ours, but ones that we learned from others. So mindfulness is really just about learning how to analytically break down the thoughts and beliefs that are creating a perception that's creating suffering for us. It's causing suffering for us. And we do this through the practice of the four questions. And the four direction system, we call it the four questions. And it's based in some ways upon the insights of the Satipatthana and the presentation of the Four Noble Truths, but it's a way for us today, a new way, a modern way, to go in and break down a thought that is creating a feeling, that's creating an action, that's creating a consequence, which is causing suffering. And in fact, I would say that the experience of nirvana, one of the ways to experience liberation, experience nirvana, is to do the four questions with something that has hooked you. And when you do the four questions and you experience that shift in consciousness where you feel freer from it, and then good feelings begin to replace the negative ones, that's nirvana, man. Nirvana is learning how to be less reactive, and that's what mindfulness does. And then the other practice is meditation. And while that word is very popular, we mean something very specific by it. And two ways in clarity. The first way is understanding how to become more spacious and less reactive to our thoughts. So the simple practice of learning to observe while we anchor ourselves in our bodies with the breath, that allows us to observe our thoughts and feelings and sensations. You know, when we sit and we observe, we label, we let go, and we recognize, and we begin to understand that all those thoughts, feelings, and sensations are not my identity. And we learn to stop identifying. And we create this very big space within which all these things arise and fall. And that spaciousness gives us a taste, an experience of our true self, the boundless and unlimited ground of our being. And the second way within which we observe meditation is the practice of abiding, as we will do tonight. And when we're abiding, we're just affirming that nothing in life can add nor subtract to our being, to our worth, to our value. I think when I sit here and abide, and I think of the liturgy itself, and I take the staff and I strike it three times, I'm saying that our worth, our value, is not predicated by the outside world. It's not dependent. It cannot be added to nor subtracted from by whatever happens in the outside world, doing and having, or not doing and not having. So the practice of abiding is to allow that spaciousness to embrace us, to be embraced by that all acceptance, that boundless love. Going back to the pop groups of the 80s, when Michael George died, or I'm sorry, George Michael, George Michael died. Boy George was asked to comment because he was friends with Michael. And what's very interesting to me is that these two pop figures both have embraced Buddhism. Michael embraced Buddhism near the end of his life. Boy George has embraced Buddhism. Another pop icon who probably became most well known during the early 80s, David Bowie, embraced Buddhism. I find that encouraging. I find that these people who, through their fame and fortune, suffered greatly, were able to find some liberation and peace in the Dharma. But Boy George said of Michael's passing, "I pray that he is embraced by the arms of the Buddha, a loving embrace of the Buddha." And I can tell you that he is. And so are you, regardless of anything you think you have done or all the things you have left undone, just as you are, without any plea, you are accepted. You are loved. And the practice of abiding is to be embraced by the loving arms of your true self. That is meditation. And then the final antidote is what we call the precepts. And the precepts are a way to respond, not react, but to respond to the poisons through action. And the first expression of the precepts is to understand clearly the power of intention and the reality of responsibility. The power of intention shows us that that is all we have to guide us, and that we don't really have control over how things work out. And so it's really important that whatever our intention is, that we spend time contemplating what it is, because when we act on our intention, we want to do that from as clear a place as we can. And we learn that, we realize that responsibility is not something that we can take for the things that we don't intend. And this, along with meditation, helps us have another experience of nirvana. It allows us to have a more sense of ease in life, less reactive and more at ease, because we're not responsible for anything that we don't intend. And that doesn't mean we don't care about what happens, unintended consequences. It just means we're not really responsible. There's no blame or shame. Blame being the experience we have around it, shame being those coming from outside. And that is liberating, man. Most people I've met that suffer from anxiety take way too much responsibility. The second aspect of the precepts is that we learn to turn a crisis into an opportunity. An opportune action that will somehow help relieve suffering. So when you think of the precepts, they're kind of broken into two categories. One, to not harm intentionally. The other to enhance. And so the precepts become the antidote to our delusion, hatred, and greed as well. They help us to act in ways that shift the way within which change, which as we know from the second principle, is the constant. Change, rather than being the enemy, becomes the opportunity. And that's a big shift, man. Shifting that practice is huge. Because we've been so conditioned to react to change in a way that's negative. So with clarity and insight, we can learn to make change a dynamic part of our existence. So there you have it. Three poisons of the mind being delusion, hatred, and greed, and the three antidotes being mindfulness, meditation, and precept. This is the whole of our practice. I wish you well.